Well, welcome again. I guess I'll begin, given that we were going to bump up against Vespers again this evening. But my name is Mike Van Quickenborn, and I've seen many of you throughout the week, but I teach philosophy at Everett Community College, which is over the mountains and through the woods, of course, and about half an hour north of Seattle. And this week I'm just teaching on philosophy in the cinema, essentially, which is a class I teach at the college. Let's see, tomorrow will be the last time I do a philosophy and cinema connection, and that, as I said, that session will be at 11 a.m., so they move us around, the teaching staff, to teach at different times. And then Friday, I believe that's at 4 o'clock, I'll be doing what's called the Socrates Cafe, so it won't be directly based in any film or anything like that, or no clips, but just an informal philosophical discussion. So if you're interested in that, I encourage you to come out. Let's see, I have a bibliography and filmography, and I have one more printed copy if anybody would like it, or I can email people. I've already got a couple people I'm going to email it to when I get back to civilization, as they say. Maybe that. Okay, let's leave that there for now. So you may have heard that tonight's topic is, or the way I've described it, is a question: is there any winning the battle for truth? And the reason I've used the term battle there is because one of the two films we're going to look at tonight is The Battle of Algiers, and then the other one is a film called Adaptation. Has anybody in here seen The Battle of Algiers? Okay, a couple of you, great, but most of you haven't, and that's always great news as far as I'm concerned. I'll get to expose you to something new. It's not humorous at all. It's kind of one of the first, you might use the word mockumentary, but that suggests it's going to be humorous. It's sort of a fake documentary, and I'll get into that in just a minute. Adaptation, the second film we'll be looking at a couple clips from this evening, is another production of Spike Jonze as the director and Charlie Kaufman as the screenwriter, and they are responsible for Being John Malkovich, which we looked at clips from yesterday. And it actually, there's a scene in Adaptation that's actually supposed to be taking place on the set of Being John Malkovich. So there's some connections there. But I'm curious if anybody has seen Adaptation. Great. So we're going to get through the more difficult, not so fun stuff in The Battle of Algiers, and then Adaptation is a comedy. And so we'll end with that tonight. So before we get into those films, though, I want to just talk about truth a little bit. And I probably don't have to convince any of you that the topic of truth is an important one. You might recall the Gospel of John, where Jesus states in chapter 8, verses 31 and 32, "If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples, then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Right, so obviously, from a Christian perspective, truth seems to be fairly important. On the other hand, postmodernism, which is what I want to touch on tonight a little bit, is a multifaceted perspective on the world, and I think that both The Battle of Algiers and Adaptation exhibit certain approaches or aspects of postmodern thinking. And postmodernism has a variety of different sort of manifestations, you might say. We could talk about postmodernism aesthetically speaking. I'm going to focus on postmodernism philosophically speaking tonight. And basically, the way I would describe it in a nutshell, in four or five words, is that postmodernism, philosophically speaking, challenges the traditional view that truth amounts to correspondence to reality. So a very common understanding of what truth is that it amounts to correspondence to reality. So if I say that it's raining in New York City right now, that claim is true if, in reality, it's raining in New York City right now, right? That seems to make sense to most people. Postmodernism challenges that view, that that's what truth amounts to. And in its most extreme versions, postmodernism can be seen as endorsing relativism, the idea that there is no such thing as transpersonal truth at all. I mean, we might say, even from a postmodern perspective, some claim might be true for you, but it's not true for me. Right? So that's what I'm talking about when I say relativism. So we'll get into that in a little bit here. The first of today's films, The Battle of Algiers, will appear to be a reconstruction of the events that took place in Algiers in the mid-1950s. All right, so Algiers was a French colony for a long time, over 100 years, and then they underwent a struggle for independence in the mid-1950s, the anti-colonial movement, which you might be familiar with. This film, Battle of Algiers, was directed by an Italian, actually, Guido Pontecorvo. with significant Algerian contributions. It's from 1966, so it's after the events that take place, of course, by about a decade or so. And I think this film is particularly interesting for several reasons, but given the events in the Middle East in 2011, the Arab Spring, but not in Algeria, by the way, right, interestingly. It's a very timely film about sort of the struggle for independence and against oppression, we might say, in the Middle East. And I'm not going to show you, but this film, Battle of Algiers, opens with the following disclaimer. This dramatic reenactment of the Battle of Algiers contains not one foot of newsreel or documentary film. Okay, it starts by making sure you're aware of that. And so this film is really best categorized as a historical drama, even though, as you'll see it, it really appears to be, in many ways, a documentary. Okay. Now, you've seen other films before that have started with a claim sort of like that. Perhaps it might begin with based on a true story.
Yes.
Right. Based on true events is another one I've seen. Based on actual events. Okay. The following is a documentary, it might say. Or here's another one that I like, inspired by actual events. Okay. So there's a whole plethora of ways to sort of begin a film, right? What do they mean? You can take any one of them, or you can talk about all of them, but what does that mean, based on a true story, or inspired by actual events, or any of these others? When you think?
Was it something like historical fiction or not?
I'm just saying, you know, you've seen films with that as a preface, right. And when you see that, sort of, what does that make you do or think, or how do you respond then to the film?
There might be some thematic kinds of things that are that happened historically that are being portrayed.
Okay, and so you might form an association between what you're about to see in the film and things that happened in history. Is that what thematically?
Yeah, not actual events, not actual occurrences, mm-hmm. but some of the themes from the time.
So if you see a film, not the one we're about to see clips of, but and it says, you know, based on actual events or something like that, and it's about some battle, you would say, well, there's some themes that are in common, the struggle against oppression or something like that. That's how you would take it.
Well, actually, you know, a little bit more than that. There were French, you know, legionnaires there fighting against folks who were in rebellion.
Okay. Right.
I always believe it more.
You believe it more. Okay. Right, and you said nonfiction, I think, right? Okay, nonfiction, yeah. I think you believe it more, right, is an interesting response, and I think that's one that I've had, right? But I'm personally not really sure what they mean, right? Based on a true story, does that mean it's 10% true, right? Yeah. Now with more truth? I don't know. What would that mean, 10% true?
Now
with
more truth. Right? I'm always a little scared, because I go back to that period of novels that depicted, you know, the robe and those sort of things. And after people read them, they almost said that was fulfilling. That was more complete than what we were reading. And I always worry about that when it's based on.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I think that, can you repeat what you said again?
Yeah, sorry. Nonfiction. Well, me?
Yes.
I believe it more.
You believe it more, right? And what I would just simply say is that these kinds of prefaces to a film based on a true story, based on true events, etc. They're simply manipulative devices that the creator is using. They want you to believe more. That's the result they want. I believe it doesn't really have any relationship to truth. I think we should avoid that kind of connection.
So you're spoiling it for
me. I'm sorry.
It's all right. It's all right. I do it all the time.
You can just end now if you like. But
that goes back to my cynicism. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Okay, and I think cynicism is certainly, but it's an attitude that we might say is at the heart of some of what postmodernism, you know, looks at, we might say. What's interesting though about this film, right, I didn't say it began with any of those phrases, right? What the Battle of Algiers begins with is this dramatic reenactment of the Battle of Algiers contains not one foot of newsreel or documentary film. So it begins by denying its relationship to truth, which I think it feels more honest, I guess we might say, and it allows the images to speak for themselves, and you don't have to necessarily say, did this quote-unquote really happen, or did it happen in this way, or am I being manipulated, do they want me to believe this? You can just simply look at what you're being shown and make your own judgments. So just note that.
Well, yeah.
official history,
yeah,
were being manipulated oftentimes. I mean, if I think about how certain historical events were presented when I was in sixth grade compared to how they're presented now, they're often very different.
Right. Yeah. And you said we're often being manipulated, I think, but the one suggestion might be that we're always.
Yes.
Okay. So that might be something to think about. Now, the first thing that I've seen that I want to show you from the Battle of Algiers takes place during a general strike that was organized by the Native Algerian Resistance / Terrorist Force, known as the FLN. What they hoped to accomplish, as it's explained in the film, was to get the United Nations to pay attention to their cause and then goad the French into responding actually harshly to their strike. They didn't want to work for the French, right? They were not going to report to work. And so they wanted the French to respond harshly so the media would see this, right? And this would generate sympathy for their cause. The idea was that without the native Algerians working, the Algerian economy would come to a halt, and that would, of course, harm the interests of the French, we can call them colonizers. Okay? So the very purpose of this general strike, which forms a large part of the film, was to manipulate public opinion and create a truth, quote unquote, for the United Nations that the Algerians were being oppressed. The French, on the other hand, saw Algeria as an integral part of France. It was territory that had been under French control for 130 years. Right? So, I mean, in 1950, I think our country was only, you know, approximately that old, so you might think about that. Before I screen the clip here, you might be wondering, you know, who are the main protagonists of the film? In the previous sessions, I said, no, here are the main characters, and this is what they're doing. But this film, in fact, is remarkably short on characters. And in fact, there really isn't a main protagonist other than the Algerian people as a whole. Having said that, the French side of the conflict is embodied very powerfully in the only professional actor in this film, Jean Martin, who portrays Lieutenant Colonel Mathieu. And the following scene is going to show French reporters asking Lieutenant Colonel Mathieu what he thinks of the war that he's waging on behalf of the French people. And I think you're going to find this scene really kind of, you might say, prescient. It's from 1966.
Have you mentioned that several of the people who play Algerians were the actual people involved in the conflict?
Yes, I haven't mentioned that. I just did something I shouldn't have. I haven't mentioned that. That's right. And they financed the film partially as well and were heavily, part of that.
Could you also say that the civil rights movement, would you characterize them as saying that they wanted the sympathies that that is a harsh treatment of people that changed the world.
Yes, absolutely. And the question is, I think...
Was the projector on when you connected things?
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't on. Well, when I say, was it on, I mean this button, not that button.
I don't know.
So let's... Pardon me.
Yeah, what I did is I got it all set up, and then I pressed the mute button, and then I thought just undoing that would work, but Joel, the media maven, will fix this. Joel is correct that the people, other than this Colonel Mathieu that we're going to see, they were non-professionals, they weren't actors at all. Many of them involved in the conflict. And one of my reasons in maybe hesitating to kind of lay that all out there is because that might make you think, right, it's kind of a little pill, okay, this is going to be propaganda, right, the French are awful, and the FLN, you know, are the heroic resistors to French oppression. But I think one of the really remarkable things about this film is that it is very even-handed. If you watch the whole thing, you will see both the French doing horrific things as well as the FLN. There's one scene in particular, which I wasn't going to screen for you, that takes a long time, and it shows these women getting bombs in purses, and then they go into the French part of Algiers, and go to various locations, including like a bar, you know, dance club, an airport, an airline ticket office, and one of the locations escaped my mind. At any rate, they set their persons down with the bombs in them, their time to go off at a certain time, and for, you know, like a minute in each location, the camera pans both the women and all of the basically innocent, right, people dancing, talking, having a good time. And, I mean, the tension in that scene is just incredible, and it really, you know, does not suggest that these FLN are necessarily heroes. So, anyway, I highly recommend it.
Who was the film produced by?
It was a it was actually, in terms of the produce, the financing?
Oh.
Yeah, it was an Italian-Algerian production, I think, for the most part. There might have been some other funding in there, but, yeah.
But their intent was not partisan, they were just attempting to portray a situation.
Well, I think the FLN people want to get their story out. I think Guido Pontecorvo did an excellent job of sort of maybe keeping them at arm's length to some extent to be able to, you know, depict what may have been more closer to the truth, if there is such a thing. Let's see. Oh, it was banned in France for a time. The first screening in France didn't happen, I think, for at least a decade.
I do not like the looks of that.
Okay, it was working. I had it all working. And does this DVD player go to sleep or something?
No, why? Let's
see if I can.
Only
don't
I hear that in general cooking.
Since we all know French, this would be French and Arabic, right? The source button. Oops, nice. I think it might be this one. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Oh dear, don't go there. All right. This is the scene.
Puis-je vous poser quelques questions, mon collègue? Dans une région, je vais passer. Dedans, au moins, ça va ce qui se passe. Absolument rien, après un premier bilan. Allez vous rendre compte par vous-même. J'ai mis tous les moyens à votre disposition. Allez faire un tour et vous verrez ce qui se passe.
En tout cas, la grève semble avoir réussi.
Non. Elle a manqué son objectif principal.
L'insurrection?
L'insurrection.
Si ce n'est pas une grève insurrectionnelle.
Et vous croyez aux affirmations du FLN?
Elles semblent plausibles cette fois-ci. Une grève générale est un bon argument pour l'ONU.
L'ONU est lointaine, cher monsieur. Comment peut-elle juger de l'importance d'une grève? Pour le FLN, il serait plus facile de se faire entendre avec les ombres, puisque c'est à leur place.
Qu'est-ce qu'une insurrection armée pourrait impliquer en ce moment?
Je tiens plus de toute insurrection armée. C'est un moment inévitable de la guerre révolutionnaire. Après une première phase de terrorisme, on passe à l'insurrection armée. C'est ainsi que de la guérilla, on passe à la vraie guerre.
Bien, bien fou.
Précisément. En Indochine, ce sont eux qui ont vaincu.
Et ici?
Cela dépend de vous.
De nous? Auriez-vous l'intention de nous faire recruter, mon colonel?
Je m'en garde. Vous devez seulement écrire et si possible bien écrire. Les guerriers, il y en a plus qu'il n'en faut.
Qu'est-ce qui manque alors?
Une volonté politique qui parfois existe, parfois non. Parfois elle est insuffisante selon les jours. Il y a plus de temps à
Paris. Rien. Un autre article de ça.
Qui peut me dire pourquoi les Sartres connaissent tous un même côté?
Alors Sartre vous plaît, mon colonel?
Non. Mais il me plaît encore moins de l'avoir comme adversaire.
So, he's making the point there that, you know, whether or not they will succeed in Algeria is going to be dependent on the media, right? And so, I mean, I think that's really an interesting point. You know, he believes that the media could play a role in shaping reality. Was the strike a success or not? That's going to be up to the media, he argues, right? So when you see that, and we'll see other clips here, but I mean, does it make sense to say that this film is true or not to you?
Well, there's some themes in it that are pretty consistent with what happened, not just in Algeria, but in other places that the United States has been involved in.
Okay, themes. themes that are consistent? Like, like an example of a theme?
Sure. The whole idea of the press being a formative issue, or a formative force in determining whether or not a country or society chooses to stand up to a particular position or goes in a different direction.
I think a good comparison would be the media's attention on the U.S. for the war.
Right.
Maybe a question would be, is that the way things were? Maybe not. Is that the way things are? Yes.
Okay.
When I say things, I'm kind of talking thematically.
Thematically.
And if it resembles the way the world kind of is, then to me that's kind of truth. Whether the details, the factoids are in precise order, that's less important. Mm-hmm.
So another way to ask that is, can we ever know what happened in the Battle of Algiers? Could we ever know what happened?
What do you mean, what happened?
Well, what do you mean by, could we ever know?
Okay.
Can we ever know what happened in World War II?
I mean, some people might simply say, yeah, well, anything, right, in the past, essentially, right? So could we ever know what happened? So one answer might be no. Another answer might be yes. Or, you know, it depends on how you define no and what happened. But I would simply point out that the postmodernist would suggest that the answer is no, we can't ever know what happened in the past, World War II, Battle of Algiers, whatever it might be. We can have accounts that are provided,
yeah,
right? Films, books, and so forth. But there is no knowing what's happened. Okay? I'm not arguing for their position, right? But this is something they would, I think,
well,
note.
I think that you have enough a scenario.
You can. And is that scenario what happened? Is it the truth?
Could you distinguish the public perception from perception of the individuals? The perception of the masses.
Right.
Towards a historic event versus the individual's knowledge personally of the event.
Right. But isn't an individual's knowledge personally of the event obviously shaped by the knowledge of the media, right? The media, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, it could depend. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You could have been there present as opposed to being back here in the United States.
Right.
Seeing it reported through the media.
Right. Okay. Here's another aspect that the postmodernists would note, and that has to do with language, right? So we just heard about the media. Let's see if I can get this to. Oops. All right. We talked about the media playing a role in manipulating how people think about certain events. Language also plays an important role, according to the postmodernists, and we might agree or not. And it's going to be, I think, evident in this scene here. From day 6 of the strike, the French, it's 2 days later from what we just saw, the French are becoming increasingly frustrated with the success of the strike. The beginning of the scene we're about to see shows men streaming back into the Casbah, which is the section of Algiers where the native Algerians lived, after they've been apprehended by the police for taking part in the strike. In other words, if they weren't reporting to work, the French were going to haul them off, you know, detain them for a time, and now they're coming back to where they live in the Casbah. And as they're streaming back into their home, essentially, the Casbah, you will see the French military addressing them and the populace of the Casbah, basically attempting to break the strike through what we might now perhaps call psychological warfare. Okay? So we'll see that here.
Next. Le FLN veut vous empêcher de travailler. Habitants de la Casbah, la France est dans votre patrie. Montrez que vous avez confiance
Mohamed.
En la France et en
Mohamed.
Sa marée.
Suivez-la. Mohamed.
Le FLN veut vous affamer et vous condamner à la misère. Habitants de la Casbah, révoltez-vous contre les mots d'ordre du FLN.
الحمد لله على السلامة.
الحمد
set and destroy things. And, at any rate, I think that's an interesting scene as well in terms of truth, because, you know, the natives of Algeria, are they going to think that the strike is being is winning, a success, or a failure? You've just heard the French talking to them about it. They're trying to starve you into poverty and so forth. And then you heard this little boy speaking in Arabic, right? And I think it's pretty clear that the Algerians took as truth what was being expressed in Arabic,
right,
in their native tongue.
And he wasn't even talking about the strike. He was talking about the freedom movement and it's wanting to be on, you know, being for them.
Right. I mean, he did say it's winning. We're winning.
We're winning, but
yeah.
He wasn't talking necessarily about the strike at all.
Right. Right, and I think it's merely the fact that he's speaking in their own language that they're going to receive that as truth. It doesn't have to be, it's a boy, right? He's not presenting them with facts about, you know, this or that. It's just the fact that he's speaking their own language. And so I just point out that the postmodernists think that, you know, language itself plays a fundamentally important role in what we understand as true or not.
And they were, the French were invading.
I mean, again,
the French had occupied them for
130 years.
That's an interesting time period. It's about the amount of time between the colonization of North America and the American Revolution.
Okay. Yeah. But I mean, you can understand. Perhaps I'm not saying it's justified, but you know, that's a long period of time. It's not as if they were there 10 years and now they're.
No, but they still. They didn't speak the language of people.
Right.
They impose their own rules and customs on the people.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think
people
forget that.
Right.
You made an important, your phrase there, there's an important distinction to me between the truth, not that I understand just what it is, and facts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think, to me, no matter how many facts I have and no matter how well verified they are,
mm-hmm.
together, it takes more than that to make up the truth. The truth is more than a collection of facts, no matter how complete or how reliable.
Okay. And so we can talk about, there are different ways to append something to the word truth, right? We can talk about, statistical truth, or objective truth, or subjective truth.
And what kind was Jesus talking about?
I know. Right.
That's the question.
Right. I'm just glad he was speaking in English, because that makes sense. Right, but there you can see again, right? I mean, you've got filters of language coming in,
yeah.
So
yeah.
How do we get to what the real truth was, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes my students forget that, I think. That,
yeah.
Most literatures, that literature was written in, not written in English.
Yeah.
So let me just also keep in mind the time here, but let me show you one more scene here from the Battle of Algiers, and I highly recommend it, the whole film. I mean, you're just getting a very small taste here of the film. But this film ends in a way very unlike a typical Hollywood film. About 10 minutes before the end of the film, the main characters as such, from the FLN, right, from the Native Algerian Force, and one of their children are blown up after a standoff in an apartment building. They've been hiding in it. Lieutenant Colonel Mathieu blows them up. It's a really interesting scene. We're not going to watch that scene. Pardon me?
I just asked if he was in.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And it's an interesting scene, I think. It came to mind with the assassination of Osama bin Laden, at least, that there was a connection there in my mind. But, and just as another side note, Film Comment magazine noted that this film, Battle of Algiers, was screened at the Pentagon shortly after the beginning of the most recent war in Iraq, in order to give our military leaders a sense of the type of fighting they might encounter in Baghdad, the relevant type of fighting. And so, hearing that, and then one of the very first scenes shows a FLN fighter, terrorist, however you want to describe that, being waterboarded. And so then that, you wonder if that's where they got that idea. Probably not, but anyway, it's an interesting connection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing.
No, they got that idea from the Korean War.
Yeah, I know it had been used before, but maybe they didn't. I don't know, maybe that reminded them of it. But anyway, the interesting thing is, after the main FLN leaders are blown up in the film, it continues, as if that was just sort of a little footnote along the way. There is a scene, we won't see it, but Lieutenant Mathieu says the head of the FLN has been cut off, right? And so he expects things to, okay, we're in control now. But after 2 years of dormancy, the Algerians begin their protests once again. And that sets the scene for the final clip from the film that I want to share with you here. By the way, excellent soundtrack here. If you like Ennio Morricone, he did the soundtrack to this, and it's just kind of amazing. Okay.
Écoutez-moi. Retournez chez vous. Qu'est-ce que vous voulez?
Interesting ending because, you know, in a typical Hollywood production, you would have some kind of reflection on the heroic individuals who had made this possible, whatever the accomplishment is. And here, we've long forgotten, 10 minutes is a fairly long time in a film, right? We've long forgotten about the leaders of the FLN, and it's sort of the mass of the people themselves that have accomplished in the end the revolution, I guess we could say. And again, that's another, I think, aspect of postmodern thinking is that there's a de-emphasis, we might say, on individual effort and on the group effort or the group, you know, consciousness, we might say, and the group itself, and that's what we see here in this film, which I think is really
so
interesting.
The truth is actually sort of the destruction of communities, and that's one of the reasons the facts don't matter so much.
Truth is found in communities, mm-hmm. is another way to think about the postmodernist approach, and that's the one I find most interesting, most maybe hopeful or optimistic, right? Because we ought to come together then as people and talk about what works or, you know, what is the truth.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Could see that as a collective movement there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see any revolution coming out of that yet, but.
Well, a revolution. Sometimes slow and quiet.
Right. This one went dormant for 2 years, and then yeah, just a fascinating scene there with the French officer speaking into a megaphone into the fog.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, not individuals, but just the people themselves. And then that music you heard come up. I mean, that comes throughout the film, and that's I think remnant supposed to be symbolizing, we might say, the spirit of the Algerian people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I highly recommend that film to you. I do want to note that I think it is pretty clear that film does shape our understanding of war. We'll talk about the theme. There was a fairly recent New York Times article, if you email me I can get you this, but it was entitled 25 Years Later, How Top Gun Made America Love War. And in this article it makes the case that there's a military entertainment complex that serves to perpetuate America's support of military interventionism. And so you can always pick up on this, because if you look at a film and you notice that the military equipment either looks fake or computer generated, okay, the military wasn't behind that effort. But if it's all looking like official military, you know, hardware, then yes, the military has to agree to let their equipment be used in those films, of course, which is a reasonable thing. But they're not going to do that, like, unless there's a message that they want to get across. So, at any rate, that's truth and more. Let's talk about adaptation for a little bit of a lighter thing here. If I can continue to make this work. Now, in the film Adaptation, I think Battle of Algiers suggests that truth is maybe hard to pin down, right, and subject to manipulation from the media and, you know, the language one might use and so forth. Adaptation, I think, in a sense, goes further and suggests that there truth may be something that's totally impossible to even get a handle on in any way. Let's see. I covered some of that. Is that, yeah? Okay, that'll be fine for now. This is kind of an odd film, Adaptation. I think anything that comes out of the mind of Charlie Kaufman and Spike Jonze is odd, but also, I think, delightful. But the first thing that's odd about this film is that the screenwriter of the film, his name is Charlie Kaufman, he himself is the main character in the film. This film is ostensibly an adaptation, hence the name. It's an adaptation of Susan Orlean's book, The Orchid Thief. The Orchid Thief, used the word nonfiction earlier. The Orchid Thief is a piece of nonfiction about orchids and human beings' desire to possess them. Now, in the very first scene that you're about to see, you're going to see the actor Nicolas Cage, who you're no doubt familiar with. He is in this film portraying Charlie Kaufman, and Charlie Kaufman in this scene is meeting film executive Valerie Thomas to discuss having Charlie Kaufman adapt The Orchid Thief into a screenplay. Right? Can you imagine that kind of scenario? Okay. It has Meryl Streep in it, yes, as well. Yeah, that's right.
He's a true fan.
Okay. Yeah, oh, she's great in this film. Okay, and that's Tilda Swinton. She's in this scene as well. She plays Valerie, the film executive.
Okay. My leg hurts. I wonder if it's cancer. There's a bump. I'm starting to sweat. Stop sweating. I've got to stop sweating. Can she see it dripping down my forehead? Oh, she looked at my hairline. She thinks I'm bald.
You think you're great? Oh, wow. Thanks. That's nice to hear.
We all just loved the mouth of their scrutiny.
Thanks.
Such a unique voice. Boy, I'd love to find a portal into your brain.
Trust me, it's not fun.
So, tell me your thoughts on this crazy little project of ours.
First, I think it's a great book.
LaRoche is a fun character, isn't it?
Absolutely. And Orlean makes orchids so fascinating. Plus her musings on Florida and orchid poaching, Indians. It's great, sprawling New Yorker stuff, and I'd want to remain true to that, you know? I'd want to let the movie exist rather than be artificially plot-driven.
Great! I guess I'm not exactly sure what that means.
Oh. I'm not sure I know what that means either. I just don't want to ruin it by making it a Hollywood thing, you know, like an orchid heist movie or something, you know, or changing the orchids into poppies and turning into a movie about drug running, you know? Why can't there be a movie simply about flowers?
I guess we thought that maybe Susan Orlean and LaRoche could fall in love.
Okay,
and
but I'm saying it's like I don't want to cram in sex or guns or car chases, you know, or characters, you know, learning profound life lessons or growing or coming to like each other or overcoming obstacles to succeed in the end. You know, I mean, it's the book isn't like that, and life isn't like that. You know, it just isn't. And No, I feel very strongly about this.
So, that scene, it is brief, but it does really summarize the whole film. This film is called Adaptation, but it's really about Charlie Kaufman and his insecurities. And he just goes through that litany of, I don't want this movie to turn into all these things, right? The car chases, orchid heist, think of all those things. Right. Well, by the end of the film, it's going to involve every single one of those things. Okay. So, I didn't get that till the second or third viewing, but at any rate, it does all of these things. Now, it might be an open question that you might have is what is a fairly mainstream comedy? How does a comedy like this call into question the very possibility of truth? And to get at that, at least as I do in my mind, I think it's important to reflect on the fact that supposedly there are events that took place, and these were primarily in Florida, that Susan Orlean recounts in her book, right? She writes about these events that happened in Florida. And then what has happened is Charlie Kaufman has taken her words from the book and produced a screenplay, right? He's a screenplay writer. And then that screenplay, in turn, was filmed under the direction of Spike Jonze. So what we witness as we watch this film is the result of all of that. So, if there is such a thing as reality, postmodernists might say, it's so far over there, right? Then you've got to go through Susan Orlean, and you've got to go through Charlie Kaufman, and you've got to go through Spike Jonze, and it's not as if he's the only one responsible for this film, right? But all of these different filters before we see what's on the screen here. And so we might worry about whether or not we can claim to know anything about what really happened based on this film. What this film does make clear that may otherwise lie undetected is the fact that apart from direct personal experience, which I think I heard you mention in the back there about personal experience. If you experience something personally, right, you might think, okay, I know what happened. All right? Now, of course, there are sometimes issues with that because our perceptions can be affected by a multitude of factors. But apart from direct personal experience, the great store of knowledge that we take for granted has arrived in our minds via avenues that are inevitably affecting what we perceive. I believe Olympia is the capital of the state of Washington. Well, how do I know that? I mean, I've driven through there. I've seen a Capitol dome and so forth. But, how do we know these things? The vast majority of our knowledge is through these sorts of channels. While the Battle of Algiers will most often be taken as historical truth, people will watch that and think, this is what happened in Algeria in this time period, as it's relating, it says, in this year, on this day, these events happened, and so forth. But adaptation prevents us from making that kind of inference, right? We see something happen on the screen. We see Susan Orlean herself basically taking drugs, snorting orchid stuff. We can't say, well, that happened or didn't happen. I mean, we know that it's being so much filtered between all of these different minds that are looking at maybe something that actually did take place in Florida. And so a postmodernist might describe us saying that this is what happened in any given film we watch or book that we read. That's a mistake to infer that that is what happened, and adaptation prevents us from even going there, we might say. Okay. Which is, I think, one of the reasons I like it. All right, let me show you one more clip from this film, then we can talk about the whole thing. This is going to be Charlie Kaufman. Part of the film shows his struggle in trying to adapt Susan Orlean's book into a screenplay, and this scene will show him lament the fact that he himself has become part of, and indeed he has become the heart of, this film.
Don LaRoche is a tall guy,
okay,
skinny as a...
No, we're not going to watch the whole movie. I used to be able to see other things.
Ants.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah, is that part of the film?
Yeah, there's a thing about ants in here. What is this going to do? Oh, okay. Thank you. Scene select. Um, By the way, in this film, you have Nicolas Cage playing Charlie Kaufman, and he also plays Charlie Kaufman's identical twin brother, Donald Kaufman. And actually, the credit for the screenplay for this film is given to both Charlie and Donald Kaufman. Now, as far as anyone can tell, Donald Kaufman does not exist. Okay, but at any rate, you're looking here at, this will be Charlie and Donald Kaufman, I believe.
What do you want? I finished my script. I'm done. So would you show it to your agent? It's called The Three. Thanks. I also want to thank you for your idea. It was very helpful. I changed it a little. Now the killer cuts off body pieces and makes his victims eat them. It's kind of like Caroline has this great tattoo of a snake swallowing its own tail. Ouroboros. I don't know what that means. A snake, it's called Ouroboros. I don't think so. But anyway, it's cool for my killer to have this modus operandi, because at the end, when he forces the woman who's really him to eat herself, he's also eating himself to death. I'm insane. I'm Ouroboros. I don't know what that word means. I've rigged myself into my screenplay. That's kind of weird, huh? It's self-indulgent. It's narcissistic. It's solipsistic. It's pathetic. I'm pathetic. I'm fat and pathetic. I'm sure you had good reasons, Charles. You're an artist. The reason is because I'm too timid to speak to the woman who wrote the book. Because I'm pathetic. Because I have no idea how to write. Because I can't make flowers fascinating. Because I suck. Am I in the script? I'm going to New York. I'll meet her. That's it. That's what I have to do. Don't get mad at me for saying this, Charles. But Bob's having a seminar in New York this weekend. So if you're stuck...
So Donald Kaufman kind of embodies the sort of Hollywood side of, I think, Charlie Kaufman's personality, we might say. But so yeah, he's realized he's written himself into a script, right? And he's lamenting that fact. But I mean, the question this perhaps poses is, don't we always do that? Right? If we're going to write something, if we're going to understand, we're always putting ourselves into that. We can't avoid it. Right? There's no... One famous phrase in philosophy is there's no view from nowhere, right? And so, yes, he's done this, written himself into the screenplay in a very literal way here, but don't we always do it, I guess would be the question, to some extent or not.
Probably.
Probably? I mean, maybe not. People certainly have argued against that, right?
Well, some of the best novelists historically have said that that's one of their strong points, is that they're able to empty themselves out of themselves and sort of start incorporating new characters, and come up with their stories.
Talking about it like just a fictional novel.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with actors. I think, good actors can really take on a different persona, without having themselves.
Having themselves. If they're a good actor, they won't bring themselves to it, it might seem. But, and that might, for acting or fiction, maybe we could think that's possible, but when it comes to somebody trying to represent what really happened, let's say, right, can we get away from that?
I think on a cellular level, even we can't, because like you said, there's no view from nowhere. You can't have a view without having it be seen by your eyes, heard by your ears, mm-hmm. and worked through whatever connections those systems have.
Mm-hmm.
You simply have to represent.
Okay. You have to bring yourself to any situation.
Some way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, the point, and what postmodernists would emphasize here, is that the truth of what happened in Florida is far away from what we're seeing on the screen here. The same thing, though, the postmodernists would argue is true for any movie, whether it's a historical drama like the Battle of Algiers or not. We're never seeing a true story. In fact, right, what we're ever only seeing, if we're talking about films, is a series of flickering lights, right, on a screen. And we make of it what we will. Is that postmodernist, typically that's unnerving for many people. But the upshot of that might be that our attempts to escape our own consciousness may be perpetually doomed to fail, just as Charlie Kaufman failed here. He could not escape himself. brought himself right into this.
You said one of the lectures you had that we can see things clearly sometimes in films that we hadn't thought of before, that we haven't seen, that we haven't perceived. However, every film we see, we bring ourselves into the film too.
Mm-hmm.
We actually see it through our eyes, our experience, our emotions, our senses. He sees it differently than me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Somebody who's been in Iraq, let's say, is going to look at the Battle of Algiers with very different eyes from myself and, you know, from other people that haven't been in war. Absolutely.
But that's where the truth comes, too. Those minutes, those flickers of light that we see, we hadn't thought of.
Okay.
Is what we bring to it as well.
And maybe we could say that the truth that we experience in those cases, it wouldn't be fair to say it's objective truth, right? Truth that stands for me and for everyone. But maybe it's a useful wisdom, we could say, perhaps. Something, you know, we've come to understand ourselves better or our place in the world better, but to sort of raise it to the, you know, put on this altar of truth, right? Maybe that's mistaken or even dangerous.
I don't know. I think you have to make some judgments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to stand on one side or the other many times.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I keep coming back in all of these seeking for truth, the message. And the messengers.
Yes.
I mean, whether you're a scientist, whether you're a person on an assembly line, whether you're a philosopher or a pastor or a prophet, but, you know, you're always dependent upon messengers. I happen to be a pastor. Mm-hmm. I can still remember constantly trying to say, now is what I'm saying true?
Right.
When I use a quote, when I use a story.
Right.
And living in a Hollywood thing, when Hollywood began to move from fantasy and the musicals and that sort of stuff into documentary, more documentary, and that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a lot of the writers who struggled with that.
Yeah.
Who really struggled with that because you have such few sources.
Mm-hmm.
You really depend on messengers.
Right. Absolutely.
Whether it be sitting in a seminar here with a philosopher, whether it be a problem, you just depend on messengers. So often the messengers blame. It's just a contemplative moment.
Absolutely.
It's not an arrival, it's just contemplative.
Yeah. I would mention, I just read a book this summer, and it relates, I think, to all of this, especially what you said, I think, pretty well. It's a book, not a film, so. It's called The Lifespan of a Fact. It's a really interesting kind of scenario. A few years ago, not too long, maybe 5 years ago, we call him an essayist, John DeGatta. Who writes for, I believe, or he did write for The New Yorker, and then I think he might have moved to a magazine called McSweeney's. But at any rate, he wrote an essay about kind of about Las Vegas and about a particular individual who committed suicide there by jumping off the Stratosphere, which is like a really tall hotel there, and kind of reflected on that, right? But it was a nonfiction essay about this. Okay, so what this book is, The Lifespan of a Fact, is... this person wanted to publish their essay in a magazine that has fact checkers.
Okay.
And so there was a fact checker who went in and looked at every, you know, jot and tittle of everything he said and tried to confirm it, as fact checkers are supposed to do in this kind of business. And there was a really, it was difficult, because we might say the essayist took liberties with the truth is one way to describe that. But he went back and forth, and they had this debate going on as to, well, I'm saying this, and no, in a certain sense, it didn't happen that way, but there's a bigger truth to be had here. And the lifespan of a fact gives you both the original essay and then the fact checker saying this didn't work out, and then the author himself responding to those criticisms, we might say. And it's a really interesting debate about what truth is in a nonfiction essay as opposed to, say, journalism or whatever.
And how this changes, you know, is Wikipedia.
Right.
There was that period of time, like 10 years ago, Wikipedia was kind of, now Wikipedia's not present.
Thanks to my efforts, but no. Right.
No, I am just...
Still used, but not used.
Exactly.
Right.
I still go to it first, mm-hmm. and then
okay, now,
right,
where do I go?
But we can talk about truth in that, we might say, looser sense, I don't know, in sort of religious context. And by the way, tomorrow, because our time's wrapping up, we'll be talking about film and religion at 11 a.m. But think about science, right? The very important world of science, it's a very important aspect of our culture. Scientists would not like what I'm saying here, right? Because they don't claim to sort of say, well, this is my interpretation of, you know, the force of gravity. This is the force of gravity. It pulls at exactly this strength, or, you know, something like this, is my understanding, right? They think that they have a handle on the world as it is, or at least that they're getting close to the way the world really is. What I've been talking about tonight, I think, calls all of that into question.
But good scientists are unwilling to change.
They are.
And the example you just gave, you know, gravity is
right.
Something that's been scientifically, it's a theory. It's a theory of gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the premises that we live on and live are theories rather than facts.
Right. You're right, and I appreciate those additions. But I think, perhaps unfortunately, even though scientists, at least theoretically, are always willing to change, right, and say, well, we used to think this, but now we don't, they're first of all reticent to change, right? They don't like to do it.
They're human.
They're human, right? That's right. And I still think that even though they think, well, I have to be open to change, there is this reality out there that I'm getting at least very close to, right? That, and what we've been looking at here, at least to some extent, calls that into question. So, anyway. That's all I kind of wanted to, the point I wanted to make tonight. So I appreciate your coming out. And tomorrow we will, if you saw the Song of Sparrows last night, we'll have a chance to talk about that tomorrow, as well as a couple other films, The Seventh Seal, a film by Ingmar Bergman, and which is one of my favorites, and then also, you haven't heard of The Seventh Seal?
No.
Oh,
gosh.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Oh, that's God. I remember.
Yeah, oh, gosh. Oops. I filled my mind with truth, and now it's afraid of anything else. Contact, which was, it's about 14 years old now. It was actually based on a Carl Sagan novel, and it's about exploration of outer space. Anyway, there's a brief scene from that I wanted to share as well. So anyway, if you can make it 11 o'clock tomorrow, that'd be great. Otherwise, Friday at 4 o'clock, or I'll be around until Saturday. Okay. Thanks. Thank you.